The ACEC Research Institute Roundtable, Building Density in the Post-Pandemic World.
On behalf of the ACEC Research Institute Board of Directors, welcome to our first roundtable of the new year as part of our series, The Future of Engineering. A big thank you to the foundation donors who have made this session possible. We've got a great group of thought leaders here today that will share their insights and expertise with us on the density challenges of the future. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce you to two of my colleagues from the ACEC Research Institute, Joe Bates, who will serve as our moderator for today's session, and Kevin McMahon, who's going to be moderating that chat box Carrie told you about and facilitating your questions for the session. So Joe, take it away.
Thanks, Daphne, and welcome everybody. I'd first like to take just a moment to introduce each of our panelists. We have Kate Whittles, who is a partner at HR&A Advisors. Kate specializes in the future of work and how best to shape places, train people, and deliver infrastructure to make today's cities ready for tomorrow's opportunities. She creates strategic plans, public-private partnerships, policies, and programs to guide governments, developers, and businesses on growing tech and innovation ecosystems in cities around the world. Welcome, Kate. Next, we have Sabrina Canner, who is Executive Vice President of Development, Design, and Construction with Brookfield Properties. Sabrina is responsible for overseeing development in the Northeast United States. She has played a key role in the construction, design, and development or redevelopment of over 40 million square feet of signature Brookfield projects, such as the World Financial Center, the restoration and renovation of the Winter Garden at the World Financial Center after 9/11. So welcome to you as well, Sabrina.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Colin Rolfing with us. He is Vice President, Director of Sustainable Development with HDR. Colin is responsible for overseeing sustainable design leadership of HDR's architecture practice. He facilitates sustainable design integration among all departments and business units. He's involved in refining the firm's design process through the creation of new sustainable tools and processes. Colin provides global sustainable consulting and thought leadership to enhance all of HDR's core services. Welcome as well, Colin.
Hey guys, how are you?
So we're going to jump right into our questions today, but first I would like to set the stage a little bit. I'm sure it's no surprise to anybody who's watching this webinar today that things have changed in the last 9 months. The pandemic has created a shift in how we work, where we work, the types of technology that we're using. And one of the big questions is, will this last? Will it not last? And if parts of it last, how is that going to affect the future of design? So our first question is, how will building designs change in the future, given the safety concerns, as well as new emerging use patterns, particularly for traditionally densely occupied buildings, such as urban high rises in the central business district, healthcare settings, and education? So let's take each of those three one at a time. And I'm going to start with Sabrina. Sabrina, what's your take on the changes that we're going to see with urban high rises in terms of building designs for the future?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. So I think some of the things we're having to take into consideration now as we're designing and developing pre-development of our buildings, creating a pre-entry screening station. For instance, anybody who is in a building today and operating in a building today, and granted it's only between 10 and 15% of our usual occupancy, but before you enter the building, you are screened for temperature, you are tagged, and before you are allowed into the building. And so these are all ad hoc right now. We are laying out lobbies so that this can be more seamlessly added should we need it. We're assuming that in a year, maybe two, we won't need this the way we do today, but there's always a possibility that this comes back or something else comes back. And now that we're understanding how we need to deal with it, we would accommodate that in the lobby. We're also looking into all kinds of technology for touchless entry. And while through the pandemic, we have understood that airborne transmission is far more likely than touch transmission, there's a confidence factor there. And so we are looking into facial recognition, QR access as you enter through a turnstile, all kinds of technologies, everything that's coming up, we're taking a look at there. Of course, and I know we'll get into more of this later, but we've added the ability to increase fresh air, filtration, UVC, sanitization. And of course, we're looking at space and making sure that dual passage is always safely accommodated, whether that be in public spaces, in lobbies, in elevator lobbies. And probably most importantly, and asked about constantly, is access to outdoor spaces, whether that be roof terraces or open public space where you can just escape an office where you need fresh air and need to move around. Because I will say working within an office today is fairly constraining. Just from a distance point of view, once you leave your perch, masks, and of course, making sure that you are socially distant.
So Sabrina, you talked a lot about these ad hoc measures and the things that you're, you know, can look at for buildings that are existing. What types of things are you looking at and thinking about in terms of new construction when it comes to safety concerns and use patterns of new buildings?
Well, really the same list. So rather than having an ad hoc space to be screened, we're designing lobbies so that there's, a niche that makes intuitive sense as you're on your way to your elevator and you're not having to run to a separate room and then come back. So accommodating this kind of a screening. We're also looking at technologies that will screen you as you enter through a turnstile. And not all markets have turnstiles. New York does, Washington sometimes, and so on. But I think the same technology would take place as you were entering your passenger elevator lobby. So there is technology now that you walk through, it recognizes you, tells you which car to get into to go to your floor, recognizes that you do not have a fever, and sends you on your way, allows you in. All of these, the filtration, much of it today is retrofitting. And so you're very much limited by what space you have and the constraints that exist today. But as we're designing, we are allowing for the highest practical level of MERV filtration possible, where in years past, we always had some level of MERV filtration. But of course, we're leaning into that and making sure that, again, the highest, most practical level of MERV filtration fits within a machine room. Also looking at UVC sanitization of coils within machine rooms and within machines. And again, outdoor space and taking advantage of every single opportunity. And so we have a number of tiny little setbacks that were previously used for window washing rigs that we're opening up and making accessible from within in our existing buildings, and just making sure that we're planning for those in the future in our new buildings. I would also add that in high-rise multifamily buildings, where the public shared space is actually only 10-15% of the building, we are full on HEPA filtering just because it's such a small portion of the building. And there again, touchless entry, whether that be a light touch to a revolver that then goes into motion, and destination dispatch that is triggered by technology, where before now, we didn't see that in a multifamily high-rise. That was really a commercial application. But again, we're trying to accommodate a confidence factor there. And so beginning to install that in our new multifamily projects too.
Great. Kate, I'd like to turn to you. First, if you have any additional insights to the urban high-rise settings, but I'd also like you to address what you're hearing and seeing in the education settings, where we have obviously a lot of students packed together along with teachers, sometimes who are much older and maybe at higher risk.
Yeah, I think trends that are happening in education and that is applicable to urban high-rise as well as just using technology in the classroom or in the meeting room and making sure that everything is as wired and connected as possible. I mean, while we are going to come back, we've adopted new patterns in terms of how we interact, and we've identified some new ways of doing both teaching and business. And so ensuring that the buildings have the right connectivity and then the spaces are set up to allow for engagement in a hybrid setting in terms of having students and both in person and virtual. I mean, I think the density, a lot of the things that Sabrina said for office will apply to education, right? The air filtration, trying to have wider hallways for passage and the like. I think the densities of students is really driven by business models and populations. And so that's harder to control. And so I think how they're going to occupy the space within the classrooms is really more the questions and what are the tools that they can do to manage that.
Okay. And Colin, what about the healthcare setting? What are you seeing or hearing in terms of the design issues for the future and the retrofitting needs for the healthcare industry?
Yeah, healthcare is very interesting. HDR does a lot of healthcare design work. We've been number one in healthcare for a very long time. And so we've been asked a lot to take lessons learned from healthcare and actually apply them to other building typologies, right? So we have people from office environments, civic environments, airports, rail stations, libraries. Everybody wants to learn how hospitals have dealt with infection control for years and years and years, using their own guidelines as well as CDC guidelines. So to an extent, they really had a lot of these protocols in place, but they're learning some new things right now. And we are seeing a shift in not necessarily operational protocols. Obviously, if you have COVID wards, protocols are different. But for future hospitals and future trends and designs and builds, we're seeing more shifts in program space requirements. So it used to be you would have inpatient rooms and a certain percentage of ICUs. Now, everything is going to be flexible to the point where it can be turned into an ICU, which means that you're going to have appropriate levels of ventilation, 100% outside air with negative pressure, the appropriate MERV and HEPA filtration for the entire block of rooms. So from a sustainability standpoint, we have to be very careful to make sure that we can design for that, but still have the controls to turn down that ventilation when necessary. So that flexibility and program space we're seeing for all of our healthcare clients now, all inpatient rooms are now had to be ICU convertible in the future to avoid any kind of overflow. And from another program space standpoint, Sabrina mentioned this a little bit, is the idea of respite and outside space. If healthcare workers weren't already overworked and stressed out and weren't getting the attention they needed for a health and wellness engagement in their environment, in their work environment, they are now. And we're seeing a lot of projects that are looking for even outdoor respite spaces on every single floor, accessible to everyone so that you can get outside when you need to from a health and wellness standpoint. I think we can talk a little bit later about all of those other technical requirements in healthcare that we're now going to maybe see in offices and higher education environments with regards to the comfort delivery systems and other protocols.
I think that would be really interesting. Sorry, there's some feedback here. But that'll be really interesting to hear what of those areas, or what are the learnings from the healthcare space, some of those you just mentioned, how they're going to be implemented in regular everyday spaces. So looking forward to hearing more about that. Kevin, do you have any questions here for our panelists?
Yeah, we have one really good question, Joe. Let me phrase it. All the panelists have talked about basically increased amenities in the three different settings you described, education, healthcare, and high rise. from Sabrina talking about pre-screening and outdoor access, to Kate talking about the density in education, and Colin talked about the different respite areas in healthcare. So conventional wisdom has that companies and entities will be spending less on space. Hearing all of this, is it possible that companies and entities in the future may be spending more on space based on the different requirements of the spaces that they'll be renting or leasing?
Colin, do you want to start us off with that?
I think I may punt a little bit, but I think it all depends on density within the space. How many people are going to come back, right? How many people can be virtual? And will you need the same amount of square footage for your employees? Healthcare, yes, you definitely will. And there will be an increased look at cost for increased ventilation, flexibility, and space. I do think you can justify that through payback calculations for health and productivity and wellness of the employees. And they're already 85% of the way there. I think it's probably a little different story for offices and higher education that Sabrina and Kate might want to tackle.
So Kate, let's turn to you next. What about the education setting? I know you kind of mentioned that there's constraints there, which I think we're all pretty well aware of. You know, the vast majority of education expenses are borne by property taxes. I guess maybe one positive aspect of the pandemic is that at least out in the suburbs, residential construction, residential purchases are growing. The cost of housing is increasing. So at least property tax assessments will probably go up. But are the localities going to pay for the extra space that's needed in these education settings? Are they going to build bigger schools or more, add on, or are they just going to put more trailers on the side?
I think this is like the $1 million question for every user, right? Whether you're commercial or not. I think from a public sector perspective, I'm gonna be the negative Nelly. And unfortunately, I think that our government is not going to invest in the way that we need to in our school system. I think we'll probably continue, hopefully we look to the, private sector when we build new schools, and we use the public-private partnership models in delivering of new schools, and ideally there'll be better quality infrastructure. But our cities and our local municipalities are gonna be significantly constrained for the next couple of years. Potentially there'll be some better savior from the federal government and investment in infrastructure. And if we take that stance, then I think public education at the K-12 level at least will get some funding. But I'm not hopeful given how we have treated education previously.
Okay. Sabrina, any additional thoughts from you?
Yeah, so representing the commercial sector here, this will become the newest gateway issue, and we will not see additional money for it from a paying tenant, frankly. I think, as we've seen previously with sustainability, becomes an expectation and a threshold question. So, and look, we're dealing with a very stressed and somewhat stalled market at the moment. I believe that if tenants come back and begin to enter the market again and look for space, this will be on the checklist, but not something that they will pay more for.
Okay.
Can I just add one thing, Joe?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead, Kate.
I mean, I think what's interesting from the commercial standpoint, as Sabrina said, tenants will be demanding more. And I think landlords have to figure out how they're going to be managing and delivering on these amenities. And is it increasing their OPEX expenses and they're able to recoup some of that through tenants? I don't know. But how do we deliver all of these amenities more efficiently to get back to the performers that we were modeling and underwriting previously? And that's where landlords are going to have to change their business model in terms of delivering on all these amenities that are demanded.
Right.
So we had one more question that I think the panel could answer. Based on, again, a lot of the amenities the panelists have talked about, outdoor space, pre-screening, you know, basically more common areas needed for the health and safety of the occupants. Does the panel think that this will be the end of these super, super high-rise buildings that we've seen proliferate against around the world, or no? That was the question. Thanks.
Can't get rid of ego.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement. We thought high rises were going to disappear after 9/11, and we've built them bigger and better than ever.
So. I would also say that it's institutionally set up for larger buildings. All our zoning pushes us to larger buildings because it's a more sustainable model. So that's not an easy thing to unwind. We're down that path and probably not going to stop because of momentum.
Good points. Yep. So I want to change focus a little bit now to some of these trends that we're seeing and in terms of how people are using the space that they have. So obviously, and Sabrina, you mentioned this, right now we only have 10-15% of the building's space is being used. Obviously, as we get through vaccinations, as we get back to a more normal way of life, people, I think, will want to naturally come back to the office space. However, everyone I've talked to said that having some more flexibility or the ability to work more remotely more often is probably here to stay. So who's going to manage the workspace? And Kate, you were bringing this up. Who's going to manage how these workspaces are used? And will everything become more flexible in terms of who sits in this desk, who sits in that desk? Will people have desks to sit in? What are your thoughts, Kate, on that? And then I'll go to Sabrina and Colin.
Well, I think a place to start to remind ourselves is that offices weren't 100% occupied before the pandemic. Right. I think the statistic is 60% occupancy of leased space. We were all out doing work elsewhere, meeting with customers, meeting with clients, visiting sites. So while we may have some more flexibility and we may start to work from home or a third space more, I think it's not going to be the significant radical change that we had before. With that said, I think, this separation, it's really about what the tasks are that people need to do and where they'll sit, right? And if people perform tasks where they need to have heads down time and dedicated rote, then they'll have dedicated spaces. But if the tasks are really about what they're coming to the office to interact, there'll be more meeting space, more colliding space, if you will, and more of an open format. But it really depends on the work that the people have to do.
Okay. Sabrina, what do you think about, what are some of the trends you're seeing in terms of the how people are using office space, how they're going to use office space, and how we can accommodate for that?
Yeah, looking around me, I'm in our office and have been for a few months. So I would say in large part, we're using it the same way we had before. Having a permanent seat has become very important, frankly, because each seat is pre-measured and at least 6.5 feet away from anybody else. And so understanding that when you sit in your seat, you are never closer than that to someone sort of provides an overlay, sort of a soft discipline to that social distancing. We also know where everybody is and who is in and who isn't, which of course becomes even more important as we contemplate contact tracing. So there's that aspect. I think the single largest change that we see is how we conference. So there's a lot of individual conferencing, just as we're doing now and from your desk. But as you return to the office, there is a desire to sit in the same room and we constantly get requests to meet. So how do we accommodate that in the future? We have to make sure that the technology is there. Not only is the technology there, but it's at a par where we can easily communicate and efficiently and effectively communicate. That doesn't always happen now, even after 9 months. And I think that that's probably here to stay, especially as people do sort of take advantage of our now ability to accommodate a flexible worker. So that there is that, and also how to accommodate people who are outside of your office population. And that very often you can deal with through operational protocols, whether that's rapid testing. There are a number of ways. Sometimes they've got their own room. Maybe we leave our office and there's an offsite sort of third party conferencing center that we use as opposed to within our own offices, so that we are segregating the population that mixes with the outside population. But I think conferencing will change and very much mirror the way we're operating today under pandemic shutdown.
Colin, what about you? What's your perspective on some of these workplace trends?
Yeah, Sabrina and Kate talked about the changes, right? Changes in program space, changes in operations, some technical elements about conferencing and how we actually work. But from the base building system standpoint, and this has an impact on sustainability, we're looking at all of the elements from a healthcare environment and how efficient they are with infection control, what can be implemented in an office environment, higher education environment. So we're going to be looking at ASHRAE 62 ventilation rates. We're going to be trying to figure out, can we go from 2 or 4 air changes per hour to a little higher, right? You know, some ICUs and ORs are at 16. We won't be that high, but we may be looking at negative pressure in some rooms like conference rooms and huddle rooms, things like that, while increasing air changes per hour and ventilation rates in the office space. We also might have additional MERV filtration, maybe 2 banks of filtration with potentially no recirculation of air. If it is recirculated, it has to have more filtration, or some spaces might even look at 100% outside air in the space. And so, you know, all of these things, are great from a ventilation standpoint, but it kind of pains my heart because, like, oh my gosh, more energy, more pressure drop, more carbon use. It's going to, you know, really take a strain on sustainability aspects unless we're smart. So we need to install better controls for occupancy, better sensors, better pullback sensors for ventilation rates, right? We need to, you know, in new construction, look at low flow velocity ducts so we don't have pressure drop. And then look at different technologies. You know, can we achieve that ventilation rate with a low energy system like a radiant system chilled beam or probably displacement ventilation, which is more effective in some cases? So we're going to have to be smart about how we do this trade-off with energy and health, and we need to do both. And so I think that you'll see a bunch of those potential upgrades in spaces where you're able to. You won't be able to upgrade all spaces to that level, but all new construction from this point on will be asking how far can we go with these strategies without breaking the bank and, you know, still having to pay back and be sustainable.
So taking that sustainability point of view that you just, or, you know, that's really in your wheelhouse. If we end up with, you know, half the people in an office on any given day, it seems to me that we could actually reduce the footprint for many office, but not necessarily the buildings, but we can put more, you know, people in the same building, more companies could inhabit the same building. Is that something that you think is realistic, not necessarily in a healthcare setting, obviously, but in some other settings?
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to wait and see what the occupancy levels are for various companies. And if we have lower occupancy, we need to have smart controls that turn back settings in spaces that are not being used. We could potentially, you know, have a overall savings in carbon emissions, depending on where they're working from. They're working at home and everything's on at home all day. That's another offset. So I think there's an opportunity there, yes, but you have to have smart controls. And like Sabrina said, know where people are. Are they here? Are they in the conference room? Are they at home? You know, let's turn back because of that, where they're located.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting to see how people respond to the a more active identification and location of where they are at various times. Kevin, do you have any questions for us?
Yeah, we do have one, Joe. So the panel question came in, will the design changes that you folks are talking about relative to increasing protocols for occupant safety, will they create more obsolescence on older buildings more rapidly than their planned shelf life? And if so, would those future uses of a new retrofitted, you know, rehab building be formulated for a different use? Is there going to be a big upswing in Regis type conference space, perhaps as Sabrina mentioned, the need for more conferencing capability for people? What do you see about obsolescence, and what do you see about repurposing these buildings that, that maybe need to be really retrofitted significantly?
So Sabrina, why don't we start with you on that one?
Yeah, I think, look, every old building is a snowflake. So I think the answer for every building is something unique. And you have to take a look at what kind of filtration can you retrofit, and what makes sense, frankly. Very often an older building, though, is completely capable for 100% outside air, for instance. So it may not necessarily force obsolescence. I think there's a retrofit for almost anything. Funding and resources is probably the constraint there. And I would also say that I don't necessarily think that flexible space is something that we are very definitely incorporating into our buildings now. I know we as a landlord are building in several locations now. And the idea that this provides sort of a safety valve for a tenant who maybe is nervous about their population and maybe doesn't have 6.5-foot spacing today, and rather than going in and completely retrofitting their space, can allow a small portion of department, discrete section of their company, can operate out of a flexible workspace within their building. So I think that this is an advent of the future. This is something that you'll see more and more of. And to your point, Regis type facilities not only will offer conferencing, but will also offer an expansion avenue.
Kate, do you have any additional thoughts on that?
I very much agree with Sabrina that co-working and the operators or landlords are going to be offering it as an element of many commercial buildings. And I do believe that that type of flexible office will start to be appearing in more, you know, denser neighborhoods as well, as people may not want to go to the office, but they don't want to be working out of their home for half the day. They need a third space. So I do believe that that will happen. I think in general, the mixing of uses is just going to continue and continue. So if some of those buildings that may become functionally obsolete for a commercial use and they're in a more dense, central business district, I think more residential may come in to those districts, just as more office may start appearing in neighborhoods.
Interesting. Colin, any additional thoughts from you on that?
Good point. I mean, retrofits have always been difficult for existing buildings, especially when it comes to controls and comfort delivery systems. I think we're going to have the same constraints we've had for the past, 40, 50 years with retrofits. It's just a matter of if the market does go in a direction where this is required, it's going to be difficult. But we can still do 100% outside air. We can still do VV boxes with turndowns. We can still do the ventilation rates. We just might not be able to do it as easily and with a better payback. So same constraints, new issues, right?
Right. Okay, I'm just going to remind the audience that if you do have any questions, please feel free to type them in the Q&A chat button. As you sort of hover over the screen, they'll be down in the center. And Kevin will, of course, be looking at those. We're going to move on to the next set of questions here, and I'm going to go right back to you, Colin, on this. What is the right balance when you're thinking about building design between cost savings, high efficiency, and now we have these health considerations that maybe are going to be greater than they were before?
Sure. I think we have to do our cost modeling and our payback analysis differently. And it's been something that's been advocated for the past few years. Hopefully this will be a wake-up call to have us run lifecycle cost analysis and return on investment calculations appropriately, which means that we're not just looking at one single system or strategy with a simple payback and then VE in and out of the project if there's no payback. We essentially have to take a holistic view of a building, all systems combined, and incorporate human health and productivity into those calculations. On all of our projects that we've seen, we spend a lot of time working very, very hard to get payback and good net present value for our envelope and HVAC systems and controls. And we're oftentimes successful. However, when we incorporate in the concept of human health and productivity, those savings are 30 times to 50 times greater than our utility savings. Always, they dwarf our utility savings. It's not even close. And so if people are concerned about increased ventilation or more controls, right, or any kind of health and wellness strategy that may be a premium, if you factor in the cost of people not getting sick, or the cost of people being more productive in the space, or the cost of people being able to go to a place of respite to de-stress and be more productive later, those numbers are astronomical. The problem is, it's not based upon, building physics where you can say, yep, this is gonna be your payback, we have an energy model. We have to create health and wellness models using research, research from people's productivity. And that is a very gray area. Everybody's productivity and health and wellness is different. My biology is different than your biology, and you work differently and you have different issues. And so you can't always assign the same level of productivity and health to every person. So we have to get better and at doing calculations for health and wellness, because it will be a no-brainer. Once you even achieve 0.5% increase in productivity for your staff, the biggest cost of your building, around 85% of the cost of a organizational's operational expenses, is their staff, not their utilities. These things become complete no-brainers and payback within a year. It's just the problem of convincing people, yes, this number is real and we can calculate it, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably the big challenge, is incorporating those dollar figures and those calculations where they've never been included before. Kate, what's your take on this area of cost savings and high efficiency versus health considerations?
I think in general, businesses are thinking about their staff more and more. And as Colin said, they're 85% or whatever of operating a business is your staff. But I think more and more we're realizing that staff is the most important thing. And so having more priority on keeping staff healthy, happy, and productive, I think is going to be higher prioritized than it has in the past at all types of businesses.
Do you think that's going to come? Do you think that's going to come from the employees themselves? Do you think they're going to be advocating for this more forcefully now?
Yes, I do. Because employees now have a lot more choice as to where they work, where they want to work. And I think they will be, as they've been pushing for other changes in work styles and behaviors, that they will be pushing for caring about wellness. I mean, wellness was a trend before, right? We had a WELL certification of buildings before. I think this will just expand and become more standard.
That makes sense. Yeah, 20 years ago when I was, in one of my early jobs, having boot camp was a big brand new thing, but certainly we've accelerated the trend towards health and wellness in the last 9 months. Sabrina, do you have anything else to add on this subject?
Yeah, I would add that taking this direction is somewhat supported by policy in certain cities. And for instance, here in New York City, Local Law 97 that is actually penalizing overuse of energy, and there are caps as to what you can do. And that is actually pushing many to install new technologies, additional controls, and allowing for variable control. For instance, we, in our most recent opening, we have a digital twin that will allow us to monitor every system in the building on one screen. Now we can also overlay on that our population so that we can dial up, dial down what our fresh air is, what our needs are in terms of fans. Every fan, every pump, everything has a variable frequency drive now, and that all comes back to this one screen. And so connecting all of these things provides us the ability to find the sweet spot for health, wellness, sustainability, and efficient energy usage. And all that is kind of propelled, I think, by some economic penalty, unfortunately. That's human nature, but it is supporting that sort of indirectly.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I would think that that is going to be more applicable to the big cities, especially, and even states like California, Oregon, Washington, perhaps, that are a little bit more at the forefront of these types of incentives or disincentives. Do you see any differences for, you know, midsection of the country, and any considerations that they might have that will differ from, say, in the Northeast? And I know your specialty is in the Northeast, but what do you think about that?
Well, I do believe that not quite as broadly applied or as heavily applied, but there are plenty of incentives and rebates coming from utilities that on a much smaller scale mirror this and do incentivize people. And so, you know, separate and apart from pandemic, there have been in my own home in Massachusetts, I changed out my controls and got a terrific rebate for it. So on a much smaller scale, I think that does happen.
Great, great insight. Thank you. Kevin, do we have any questions?
Yeah, Joe, we do have one. The panel has mentioned the increasing focus on health and productivity versus the traditional focus on space, of cost savings, and efficiency. Many crises have unintended consequences. So the question is, and Kate mentioned that employees have many more choices to go these days than used to be, particularly in the engineering business, with even in this crisis is almost full employment. Could an unintended consequence of this crisis be that people spend more on space in more places, that the traditional, let's all focus on pushing folks to headquarter locations or big employment centers, translates into keeping those places for, you know, occasional gatherings, but offering employees, rather than just work at home options, work close to home options to get some of that productivity increase, get away from the house, be productive with certain colleagues that may be in your work group, but you get the sort of the personal benefits of reduced commuting time and a lot more flexibility. You know, that could that happen with this pandemic?
Colin, what do you think on that one?
I definitely think so. I mean, we just saw that Twitter said everyone can work from home from now on. We're no longer having offices. I mean, that is a one side of the spectrum. My side of the spectrum, you know, the design practice at HDR, you know, we're really flexible. Some of the engineering groups want to be closer together. I mean, it's going to depend on the company, but I think that we can do it if need be. I think that we can be productive working from wherever. And this new generation, every millennial kind of expects that, you know, and I think that gathering and having a central location gives you a sense of identity for your group or your company. And I think that's important. I think we might find spaces that are just kind of the gathering. It's gonna be a new kind of design space we don't really see before. It's not really an office space. It is your your gathering point for events and for communication. It should really be really interesting. I think that could result in a whole new kind of design space that we haven't really thought of before.
Okay. Kate, I know you mentioned that aspect briefly. Do you have any additional thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is you look at a company like Dropbox, who said everyone can work from home. We're keeping our offices, but our offices are turning into studios. And all collaboration work happens in our offices. But when you need to do, you know, independent work, you can do it from anywhere. And I think that kind of change may happen in many different companies. I mean, there is a value to having office space, culture, mentorship, being around other people. But as we've experienced, there are some values from working at or close to home, some benefits. I think almost, you know, office space may become an amenity, an employee amenity that people will want to have, especially younger and younger generations who want, you know, they don't want to be cooped up with their roommates. They do want to go somewhere and do their work.
That's a good way to say it. Office space as an amenity. I mean, it should be a
but
cool
I mean, as an employee. Yeah. I do believe that.
I think that's a really interesting point as well, because again, when I look back 20 years, you know, we were just moving into a more open office space floor plan, you know, moving away from the vice presidents having the windows in the offices and everyone else having the inside, you know, offices. So it's, yeah, looking at office space as an amenity, I think that's a really interesting point. Sabrina, do you have any thoughts on this?
Sure. Well, as the real estate owner in the group, oh, I hope so. I hope everybody needs more space, really do. But I'm going to agree wholeheartedly with what my colleagues have already said. I think we have found that culture is such an important factor here. All of our large tenants have actually called in. We've had roundtables where they said, okay, tell us how you came back, because we'd like to come back. Those, you know, the creative collisions that happen when you're together in an office, it's kind of the human math of 1 + 1 = 3. So that just doesn't happen when you schedule and you talk. That is how you get things done, how you get kind of accomplish the housekeeping of the work you need to do. But the actual creative side of it just needs to happen when we're together. It's spontaneous. And I will also agree with Kate that, you know, we kind of felt that when we were out of the office, those that suffered the most were our younger group, our young employees that want to be sitting, and we have been open plan for 8-9 years now. They want to be sitting next to their manager, and they want to understand, they want to be able to hear how problems are being resolved and how ideas are being created and how opportunities are identified and then acted on. And that just doesn't happen in a screen. So not too worried about the future of office. I'm worried about the timeline. Would love for it to be in a month, 2 months, more likely end of the year.
Sure, that makes sense. And I know we're going to have sort of a dip in construction activity for office space for probably for a few years as people adjust to the new normal. The last set of questions, the last topic area I want to hit on in our 10 minutes that we have left is the use of outdoor space. You know, how are we going to use outdoor space more? And will we use outdoor space more in terms of our building designs? Colin?
I think it'd just be more intentional. And this applies to suburban and urban environments. You can't just provide, hey, there's an outdoor space right there. We're good. We've met our requirements for outdoor space. It's going to be based upon access, how easily you can get to it, what the walk times are, what amenities are then in that space to allow for shade and actual respite. You just can't provide a turf grass location next to a parking lot. I think that outdoor space will be intentional, which means that it's not just outdoor space, it's a place for respite, stress relief. It has a purpose, right? Hopefully it has a design purpose too as well, and it fits into the design. And we're seeing a lot of that. We have a very large hospital right in the middle of San Francisco, every single floor and all 12 floors has gardens, right? And so you know, that is going to become part of the program space in the future is respite on all areas easily accessible.
What is going to happen with the seasonality? Obviously, in the South, you may not want to be outside during the summer, whereas in the North, you're going to not want to be outside in the winter. So are we going to see spaces that are really only seasonally usable, or will there be, you know, inventions or ways to use the space that will be applicable all year round?
I think you can mitigate anything. If you study the climate, you can mitigate solar. If you study the climate, you can mitigate cold as well too. So if you're a smart designer, then you can figure it out.
Okay. Kate, what are your thoughts on this topic?
I think what's interesting, and this is unknown, you know, we've thought about outdoor space for respite, for relaxation. And I think the question is, will we be using outdoor space for production, for doing work? And that, I think, you know, that's to be determined. I think if we design it so that you can do work outside, I think it will be used, but it will require a different level of management of space and design of space to have it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see it being a problem if a big gust of wind comes along and your papers fly all over the place. So certainly some things to solve for. Sabrina, what about in the really densely populated cities? How are you going to use more out space, more outdoor space?
Well, it's funny because the city is really ahead of this. And here again, zoning, I'm invoking zoning, but zoning has really required a fair amount of privately owned public spaces. And so I know we have actually enjoyed this part and really embraced this part of development. So if you look at any of our large complexes, we've got a very large open space, and we take a great deal of care to make sure that they're properly programmed, that there might be music there, from time to time, there might be performances, it might be food offerings, make sure the retail is exciting, that you can drop in, drop out, make sure that you've got very strong Wi-Fi. So if someone wants to sit down with their laptop, as we said, maybe not a sheaf of papers, but with their laptop, and a variety of types of seats so that you can be social or you can be alone. And I think it's also important to kind of push those shoulder months and get as much use out of the open spaces as we possibly can. So we're, for instance, looking into some limited radiant heat in certain areas so that we can at least improve the warmth at a personal level, as opposed, you know, we're not contemplating heating an entire plaza, but right outside of a restaurant, for instance. So I think there are a number of ways that we can really lean into this and make these spaces exciting and more available to people. And then it's up to human creativity to use them.
Great. Kevin, do we have a final question from you?
Yeah, we do. The panel's brought up some very enlightening topics about the future changes. Question is, will collaboration, desirability, and productivity concerns start driving companies' decisions for space considerations and therefore design of those spaces immediately? Or do you see this as a long-term trend that'll evolve slowly?
All right, so let's do 1 minute each or less. Colin?
People have very short-term memories, and I do hope that lessons learned from the past year and a half, or probably 2 years, are adapted sooner rather than later. Otherwise, I fear people will forget, and we may go back to business as usual. I guess my only answer is I hope that those concerns about productivity and collaboration and how to be safe at the same time, we can start solving these right away and not wait too long, because then people tend to forget. So. Maybe not the optimistic answer.
All right, Kate.
I think with lots of things with this pandemic, I think that was a trend that was happening before, and I believe it will just accelerate more as we, you know, the health concerns are lessened and we can, you know, feel more comfortable leaving our homes or have the ability to leave our homes. But I think, you know, lots of companies were thinking about productivity and creativity and designing their space and choosing their spaces before. And I think it just become more mainstream after.
Okay. Sabrina, I'm going to give you the last word on this one.
Okay. I would say we've surveyed all of our large tenants, and by and large, most of them plan to return to office after Labor Day. And the thinking is that the pandemic will largely be behind us. And they're assuming that most people will be vaccinated and children will be back to school. So I don't think they're really contemplating a major change to the way they worked previously. And I do think some of the things that we've talked about here today, some of the technology, some of touchless entry, we have personally taken the view that we shouldn't undertake these things unless they're actually absolutely additive to the real estate. And they all are. They all are. And as Kate said, many of these trends predated the pandemic. And so to the extent there are shifts, and there are more shifts, they're not wholesale changes, they are here to stay, and they were coming before the pandemic.
Great. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists, Colin, Kate, Sabrina, thank you so much. And Kevin, of course, as always, thank you for fielding the questions. I'm going to pass it back over to Daphne for a few closing comments.
Thanks, Joe. And thank you all for joining us today. A lot of really great insights that have me thinking about some new potential research that the Institute needs to consider on some of these topics. So Colin, Sabrina, Kate, Kevin, and Joe, thank you all so much for all your insights. Thank you to our donors for making this session possible. We have a short evaluation that we'll send you this afternoon. We'd really love to hear from you about your experience of this session. Be sure to join us for our next session, which is scheduled for February 11th. And the focus on that will be sustainability and renewables. Thanks so much. Have a great afternoon and stay safe, everyone.